I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Some Wyandotte County residents with a criminal record could soon see those blemishes removed. That could mean an easier time finding a job or a place to live. Today, the district attorney there tells us who qualifies for an expungement and how they go about getting one. We'll also ask about the Conviction Integrity Unit and why one detective, accused of preying on KCK's black community for years, never faced disciplinary action. Then, an aircraft carrier made of ice, many bombs strapped to flying mammals, and cats as listening devices? I'm not describing a cartoon. We'll learn about some out-of-this-world spy ideas that were actually considered. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Wyandotte County District Attorney Mark Dupree is here to announce the launch of a countywide expungement program that launches on Wednesday. This is an opportunity to rid one's public record of arrests, convictions, or diversions. The district attorney will also talk about his Conviction Integrity Unit. This comes in the wake of Lamont McIntyre's release from prison after he was falsely accused of the 1994 murders of two men. McIntyre wound up spending 23 years in prison. A detective who worked on the case has been accused of preying on black women for sex and pursuing the wrongful murder conviction of McIntyre, who's the son of one of those women. The detective has never been disciplined. Some Wyandotte County residents, meantime, are calling for city leaders to fire KCK Police Chief Terry Ziegler, who once worked closely with the disgraced detective. Ziegler faces charges that he was double-dipping in connection with his work on a local lake house. The Kansas Bureau of Investigation has turned over its investigation to Mark Dupree's office. There's a whole lot to unpack here. Mark Dupree is the Wyandotte County District Attorney. Welcome to Up to Date. So good to have you here, Mark.
It's a pleasure. Thanks so much.
The expungement program may affect the most people, so let's begin there. This Expungement Day Resource Fair will be on Wednesday. What's going to happen?
So on Wednesday, it will be the beginning of this expungement fair that will run summer long. And we will be there
every Wednesday, right?
Every Wednesday at the Kansas City, Kansas Community College from 2 o'clock to 5 o'clock. Now, this Wednesday, it will be from 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock. And what it will allows for individuals to come in with their ID and their information. My office, along with pro bono defense lawyers, the Kansas Legal Services, and others will be there to assist so that they can review their cases and potentially get their record cleared after they file the appropriate paperwork with the courts.
Why is this being held? What's the point?
Well, it's been held because we understand and know that the data shows that by the age of 23, nearly one in three Americans will have been arrested and or convicted, which means one in three Americans are walking around with a criminal record. Now, here's the catch. We know that you're 50% less likely to receive a job offer in America if you have any type of arrest or conviction on your record. So if we want to allow these individuals who may have made the biggest mistakes of their lives in getting this criminal record, but they've served their time, they've paid their debt to society, the statute shows that or says that 3 to 5 years have passed since that time has occurred, give them a second chance so that they can become a part of the tax base rather than the tax burden.
I'm wondering what can and can't be expunged from someone's record, just in broad terms. What are you looking at here?
Well, in broad terms, the statute makes it clear that capital murder, murder, first degree, rape, and more violent crimes of those sense cannot be expunged. But over 90% of the cases that we deal with in our county and across the country are not those cases. Those are the ones that are reported the most. But the vast majority of the cases that come through the local offices are those that are not murder. And so those individuals who are dealing with drug conviction, traffic convictions, and things of that sort, theft, and you've paid your debt to society, you've been a law-abiding citizen, we want to give you the opportunity that the legislature said that you could have to come in and file your paperwork. We've connected with the court, and on Monday through Friday, if you can cannot make it to the Kansas City, Kansas Community College, you will be able to go down to the courthouse there in Wyandotte County at 710 North 7th Street on the third floor. And the district court provides what's called a help room, where there's a computer there, several computers where you can go in, fill out the paperwork. What we've done in my office is really put everything online. Before, you would have to have a lawyer, which would charge $500 to $1,000 to even fill out the paperwork. Sorry, defense lawyers, we put it online so that they can take that cost away, so that individuals who are already struggling to try to find funds can have that opportunity without that cost. There's a $195 filing fee, and the Kansas Legal Services, as well as some local scholarships, are available. And if they are approved, then they would be able to get those scholarships, not even having to pay the $195. And so the goal is to give them a chance to get their record clear so that they can get a job.
I was going to say, this program could really turn somebody's life around, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And many who deserve it, who paid their debt to society, who's done well, and who's been out here trying to do their part. And the district attorney's office here in Wyandotte County, our focus is being more proactive. We don't want to just wait and lie for individuals to mess up again. We know that the biggest obstacle for getting a job is a criminal record. And the biggest reason for folks going to commit crime is for a lack of job. Yeah. And so we're trying to jump in and stop this cycle.
Does this expungement program, does it cover every record that someone has, or just what's on file with the unified government? I mean, if the Highway Patrol makes a stop, is the record expunged if someone completes the program?
If you complete the paperwork, and the case has to be out of Wyandotte County, so you have a Highway Patrol ticket that occurred in the perimeters of Wyandotte County, yes, you can file for expungement there. It goes before a judge. A judge then will sign off on this order. And I think it's also worth noting that we run a criminal history check to determine whether or not these individuals have been law-abiding citizens, and that their record applies according to the statute, and that information goes before the judge, and the judge then makes that ultimate decision. But we will not object if they have done their part. And then the judge will go ahead and clear that record, which will come off of every record that's out there, except for the purposes of law enforcement. Police and law enforcement will still be able to see that information if they commit another crime or something of that sort. So it's only for purposes of employment, or, you know, that neighbor, neighbor who goes in and runs your criminal record.
Does every county in the state, are they offering expungement days, or is this something unique to Wyandotte?
So this is something unique to Wyandotte. I got to tell you, and I got to give a shout out here to Todd Thompson over in Leavenworth. He and Mayor Wilson spoke with me last summer, and they were focused in on doing this thing, and they did it for about 30 days, I believe. And after speaking with them, one of the biggest issues that they ran into is that, you know, they had a lot of individuals. Well, I'm a little competitive, so I told a county attorney out there, and I told him, said, look, I gotta challenge you. And so you did it for 30 days. We're going to do it for the whole summer. And our goal, as it was in Leavenworth, I know that Sedgwick County has done it. I know that Douglas County and Shawnee County has done it. The focus is, look, we have prosecutors in positions now who are not trying to simply do traditionalistic things and waiting for folks to mess up and simply lock them up. But we're trying to give them an opportunity to get back into the community, to do what's right, and us being proactive and doing our part, seeing that that is the problem. So not everyone is doing it, but those who, I guess the phrase, are smart on crime are doing it.
And this program, how many people do you think are going to take part? Any sense?
I tell you what, looking at other counties, it's been hundreds in different counties. Here in Wyandotte County, I don't know how many, but we're prepared for as many that are going to come out. And that's why we're doing it the whole summer. I believe in Sedgwick County, they did it for one day and they had to turn people away. And we don't want to have to turn anyone away because of the time. So if we can't get them all in on that day, they have the whole summer until August 14th to come on down to the courthouse, or come to the community college right there at 6565 State Avenue at the Kansas City, Kansas Community College Technical Education Center to come in and get this done so that they could have a shot at getting a better job.
This is 4 to 6 this Wednesday. Then every other Wednesday, every Wednesday this summer, it's going to be from
2 to 5 o'clock.
2 to 5 o'clock. So yes, people have lots of opportunities to take advantage of this.
Yes.
Wyandotte County District Attorney Mark Dupree is my guest. Let's turn to a different topic. You've created a conviction intelligence Integrity Unit in Wyandotte County. What's the point of it, and what does it do?
Well, I'll tell you, the United States Supreme Court said in 1935, and I quote, "The U.S. prosecutors are servants of the law with a twofold aim, of which is that the guilt shall not escape, nor innocence suffer." And so as a prosecutor from 1935, our United States Supreme Court made it known that our job is not simply to lock up those who make or convict or who are convicted of crime, but it is also as much our job to make sure that innocent folks are not suffering wrongfully. And so it goes on to state that we have to make sure that we are not pursuing wrongful convictions knowingly. And so this conviction integrity unit that is popping up all across the country with proactive prosecutors are saying, look, we realize that sometimes system makes mistakes. And any system that has human beings in there, it's flawed. Why? Because humans are flawed. And so it's not good enough in my book to acknowledge that there may have been mistakes when we have the ability to fix them and do something about it. This Conviction Integrity Unit reviews those cases where individuals say that they have been wrongfully convicted or that they did not receive all of their constitutional due process rights. Now, here's the catch. Not everybody falls into that category. Mm-hmm. And so there's tons of cases that are absolutely going to be turned away. But I'll tell you, for that one that's innocent, that should not have gone there to prison wrongfully, then it's our job as prosecutors across this country to stand up and do something about it and not simply say, I'm sorry.
Is this unit a direct result of the wrongful prosecution of Lamont McIntyre, who I mentioned earlier was falsely accused of the 1994 murders of two men? He wound up spending 23 years in prison.
And what I'll say is that in Lamont McIntyre's case, we found and the judge agreed that there was manifest injustice there. And I know you used the term wrongful conviction. The legal term that we used was manifest injustice. Mm-hmm. And when I came into office, I'll tell you that there was many folks who had attempted to contact this office for years, since 2010. And it wasn't until this administration got into the office that we were able to start looking at the case, because the default was simply to ignore or to object. And I believe that if our job is to make sure that the innocent does not suffer, then we need to investigate. We need to look at these things and acknowledge. And when we got into office, that manifest injustice was shown. It was there. And that brought about the thought process of if this happened in one case, how many more are there? And we need to make sure that we are prepared so that we will not be ambushed. And I got to tell you, when I came into office, it was a surprise to run into this situation. Mm-hmm. I didn't grow up thinking that this was the case, but when I walked into the office, it was, wow, this is real. And so we wanted to put something in place so that individuals who are innocent or who's not innocent could still have a process to go through so that they can feel that they have been heard.
Hey, have you turned up other examples since this unit's been in place?
No, the unit is still going. It's ongoing, and they're reviewing quite a bit of things in there. And of course, when they're ongoing cases, the law doesn't allow me to speak directly to them.
A key figure in the conviction of Lamont McIntyre was a police detective named Roger Golubsky. Numerous residents say this detective used his power to terrorize the black community in Kansas City, Kansas, for years. You said you were going to investigate Golubsky. Have you done so? And what was the outcome? Where are we with this?
Well, and I'll tell you, just quoting Rule 3.8, which doesn't allow me to get too much into that. I will say, yes, I have investigated. And yes, the Kansas Bureau of Investigation has taken that investigation, and they are reviewing all of the evidence and all of the information concerning that. And so it is a long process. It's a process from 24 years ago. And so I know that the Kansas Bureau of Investigation is doing their duty and taking their time and being very careful with reviewing everything.
So if I understand right, your department did some investigation, then turned that material over to the KBI?
Correct. So everything that we did concerning the Lamont McIntyre case, we then finished that case and then contacted the Kansas Bureau of Investigation, specifically concerning Detective Golubsky, which was not the Lamont McIntyre case.
You know, in fact, the entire prosecution of Lamont McIntyre has come under question. The prosecutor was accused of intimidating witnesses. The presiding judge had a romantic relationship with the prosecutor before the trial. None of that was ever disclosed. The case appears to have been a giant mess. I'm not sure if that's a legal term or not, but that's my term. Where do we stand with all of that? Because the judge is still on the bench. None of these parties have ever been disciplined. Why not?
Well, and I'll tell you, the judge has retired. And there's a lot of stuff that's out there that have come to light. But concerning the actual case and the legal aspect of it, the things that were needed to see the issues were brought to light and were dealt with.
Is the KBI investigating these other parties?
I don't have an answer for you.
I mean, residents want answers here. There's been protests going on. There's clearly some unease in your community.
I understand that. And I think the main focus is where we saw that criminal activity may or may not have occurred. That investigation is happening with the Kansas Bureau of Investigation. There were, in any given case, there are tons of people that are involved in the case. And we can cherry pick, if you will, any individuals that we want out of the judge, the prosecutor, the investigator, the bailiff. You got all kinds of people there. But our job is to pursue cases that we believe that there's probable cause that a crime may have occurred. And that's what we're doing. We're not sitting on our hands on this thing. But those a lot of this stuff that also came out with the McIntyre case was not concerning the law. It was concerning just rumor and a lot of storytelling. But the facts that came out concerning the law, concerning Detective Galuski, concerning Mr. McIntyre is being dealt with. And the rest of it is not our issue.
But the judge having a romantic relationship with the prosecutor in the case would raise eyebrows in courtrooms anywhere in this country. That's a pretty serious deal.
Well, you know, a lot of things can raise eyebrows. The question is raising of the eyebrows illegal? And that's where the issue comes. And we're talking about crime, right? Mm-hmm. And that's where my focus is.
Is your police department currently under investigation right now, Mark? What can you tell us about that?
But
in connection with the police chief, in connection with double dipping, I'm going to ask you about that here in just a second.
Well, and if you ask me about that, here's where I'm at. I have not requested that the police department, any of the police departments, be under investigation. And I want to make clear that we have 7 different law enforcement agencies in Wyandotte County. We have Bonner Springs, Edwardsville, USD 500, Kansas City, Kansas Community College, KU Public Police Department, and the Wyandotte County Sheriff, of which we work hand in hand with, who gives of themselves daily to go out and assist this office in taking criminals off the street and making sure that our community and say is safe. And so our focus is to work hand in hand with all of our law enforcement, with all of our chiefs and with all of our sheriffs to make sure that we're working for our community and working for our people to make this community safer.
Again, Wyandotte County District Attorney Mark Dupree is my guest. Last month, the KBI, the Kansas Bureau of Investigation, turned over its case to you involving the investigation of KCK Police Chief Terry Ziegler. This is what some have called for double dipping in connection with a local lake house owned by the unified government that Chief Ziegler lived in and worked on. Ziegler received some kind of credit from the unified government for the work he did on the house. Where does that case stand in your office?
That case is still under investigation. And here's the process. When any person raises the issue that they believe that a crime has occurred, the procedure is that the police department, or in this case, because we needed an independent agency to come in, right? Mm-hmm. So the Kansas Bureau of Investigation does that investigation. We have hundreds upon hundreds of investigations that occur daily. And here's the focus. The process is to investigate to see if a crime has occurred. Just because someone is being investigated does not mean that they committed a crime. And so where we are in this process is the investigation. The case was turned over to my office, and we're talking through this whole process to figure out where this investigation is going to lead us. And so that does not mean that we're going to reach the conclusion that some illegality happened, but what we will reach is a conclusion of the matter of yes or no, it did not at that point, then we'll be able to talk more about
it. Still, you have protesters who are walking the streets calling for the chief to be removed from office. And again, he was a former partner of Detective Golubsky in the police department. Your message to the protesters then would be what? This is premature, what you're doing?
Well, no, I don't think that it's premature. My message to the protesters would be that our job and our desire is to serve all of Wyandotte County, and that we're doing our due diligence as the district attorney's office to investigate any allegations of wrongdoing. And that's where we are in this process.
If strong evidence were to emerge regarding the chief's knowledge of and failure to stop or report Golubsky's conduct, would there be any legal charges that could be brought against the chief?
You know, I don't have an answer for you on that one. I mean, there was a lot of stuff that was said during that time, and there was a lot of names thrown around, many of folks who was on the force, out of the force. And quite frankly, maybe it doesn't look good, and maybe it's not something that some would say is okay. But again, the question is whether or not there's probable cause that you believe that a crime has occurred. And so that's where we are on that.
Maybe just a final point here, and I appreciate the answers you're giving me here, but to what extent has Detective Golubsky's work, the chief's involvement with the Lake House, tainted the entire police department? And that falls perhaps somewhat under your purview. What about that part of all this?
Well, you know, here's what I'll say to not only, right, the citizens of Wyandotte County, born and raised in Wyandotte County. I love the DOT and every person that lives in the DOT, including our law enforcement officers. We have over 340 plus law enforcement officers in the Kansas City, Kansas Police Department. The police department is more than one person. The police department is more than a board of folks. This is 300 and some folks who are citizens who's given themselves and recently their lives to what they believe in. And so in my book, the ones that who are serving and who are just and who are coming out working hard and putting their lives on the lines and their families sacrifices daily, you know what? Forget all of the Golubsky stuff and forget all of the nonsense of what some are doing, because we know we have the majority who are working and in the Bonner Springs law enforcement, the Edwardsville, the Sheriff's Department, the KCK Police Department, who are putting their lives on the line and doing good. Here's where I stand with it. Wyandotte County citizens, including this Wyandotte County District Attorney's Office, stands with every law enforcement officer in Wyandotte County who is standing for right and who is doing right. And where anyone does wrong, then we don't stand for it and we don't agree with it. So we are backing every person who is in law enforcement in Wyandotte County as long as they are backing justice. And when they do not, this DA's office will call them on it.
Okay. When there's further developments, I hope you'll come back on. That's Wyandotte County District Attorney Mark Dupree. Mark, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk with a top administrator of the National Spy Museum about some crazy stuff spies have tried over the years. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, our smart money experts gave advice for planning out finances before and after having a baby. Hear that conversation and other previous episodes. You'll find them at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we'll talk with the soon-to-be-determined mayor of Kansas City, which reminds me to remind you that today is Election Day in Kansas City. Polls are open until 7 o'clock tonight. Well, how about turning an ordinary house cat into a covert listening device aimed at helping the U.S. keep tabs on the Soviets during the 1960s? Or how about this idea to win the war in the Pacific during World War II, arm bats with napalm, then turn them loose in Japan as a way to win the war without endangering further U.S. servicemen and women? Another idea to defeat Japan, create an artificial tsunami using nuclear warheads. All these ideas were seriously considered and even tested at a cost of millions of taxpayer dollars before ultimately being rejected as too dangerous, too expensive, too far ahead of their time, or even possibly certifiably insane. Vince Houghton, the historian and curator of the International Spy Museum in Washington, writes about all this in his new book, Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. Vince Houghton is the host and creative director of the museum's podcast, Spycast. He joins us now via Skype. Vince, good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
I love this one. Tell us about Acoustic Kitty, this attempt to make a covert listening device out of a house cat, because on a lot of levels, this one sort of made some sense to me.
Well, I mean, it makes sense at face. I mean, the idea is if there's a cute little kitty walking up to you and rubbing up against your legs, you're going to reach down and scratch it and not pay it any attention. But the CIA figured, hey, what if we turn one of these into a covert listening device? It would be the perfect way to listen in to communications of anyone around the world. And this was actually done. I mean, it was got all the way through the actual operational phase. They, in a surgical suite, they had a veterinarian implant a covert listening device inside a cat. Its ears were used as the microphone. Its tail was the antenna and had a power pack put inside its abdomen. And then, of course, anyone who's spent about 3 minutes around a cat or even less will realize that the difficulty, of course, is training a cat to have it do what you want it to
and
do.
And you can't do it. That's why they're right. Worthless, Vince. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's no matter how good the CIA was, they ran into some issues there. But there is a version of the story where they were able to get around that problem by using electric stimulation in the cat's brain. We don't know if that's 100% for sure, but it's an interesting aspect of this story that eventually they brought it out and they decided to do a field test, or they didn't. And I love this story because this is the CIA we're talking about. So documents are redacted. They're missing. They've actually been destroyed. We know for a fact that some of the documents about this have been destroyed. And so I tried to do my best to piece this story together through talking to people who were around, talking to people who might know a little bit more than I do about this, and to try to dive in as deeply as I could into the archives.
Hmm. Another problem here was that back in the early 60s, listening devices weren't as advanced as they are now. How was that an issue back then?
Well, the problem they were trying to solve, and all of these plots, as ridiculous as sometimes they might seem, they were all trying to solve very difficult problems. And the problem in this case were bugs or covert listening devices picked up everything. And that might sound great for a covert listening device, but when I say everything, I mean everything. If you put a bug on the bottom of a park bench, it wouldn't just pick up the conversation on the bench above it. It would pick up dogs barking and the wind blowing and footsteps and people chatting across the park and the wind blowing and everything else except for or including the conversation on the bench. And audio technology today would have no problem with that, right? You could separate it out using computers. But in the 1960s, you just didn't have that opportunity. So it was very difficult to listen into the conversation we wanted to listen into with the audio technology of the time.
Now, you actually came across redacted documentation of this experiment involving the CIA. So there's no question here that this was a serious attempt at espionage, right?
No question whatsoever. There's a document that backed this up. One of our board members here at the museum is the former head of the Office of Technical Services at CIA. So if you've seen a Bond movie, he's the CIA version of Q in the Bond movies. Now, he comes to CIA after Acoustic Kitty, but he's confirmed it. It happened. He had clearances. He talked to people who were involved, and he knows for a fact that the CIA tried to do this. So this is not something that I'm making up, or it's not an urban legend, or it's not hearsay. This is something the CIA tried.
Vince Houghton is my guest. He's the historian and curator of the International Spy Museum in Washington. His new book, Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. You write in the introduction to this book that this is ultimately a book about desperation. How so?
Well, there's a reason I chose stories from World War II and from the Cold War. Because these are times when the United States and some of our allies truly face existential threats. And that word gets thrown around all the time, right? I can't remember the last presidential debate that didn't have somebody saying Al-Qaeda is an existential threat or Iran's an existential threat or whatever. That's nonsense. Existential threats are literally threats to our existence. And you could say the Nazis or the Imperial Japanese and certainly the Soviets during the Cold War with their 65,000 nuclear warheads were a threat to our existence. And during these times, we might make decisions we wouldn't otherwise. In many cases, we're desperate to do something, anything, to make us safer, to mitigate this existential threat. And these are some of those decisions that were made to do things that we never would even come close to thinking about in other types of situations. So these were plans, programs, technologies born out of desperation.
You know, what do we know today, Vince, about How far some of our adversaries were willing to go during times of war to get an edge on us, or even vice versa, how far this country was willing to go.
Well, the interesting thing is we in the United States, we have this tendency to think that we're kind of above getting dirty. One of the stories in the book demonstrates right off the bat that the United States was actually the first country in the world to contemplate using biological weapons in World War II. And we had this idea before anybody else did. We're not above that. And our enemies and our adversaries are certainly not as well. And whether or not we're going to do these bad programs, we should be thinking about them. And we still do think about every possible contingency. And that's the job of intelligence agencies. You're supposed to think about things that you don't get surprised. And hopefully the better angels of our nature will come through and we won't do anything terrible. But we better be thinking about other people and other people potentially doing bad things to us. But we're certainly not above criticism when it comes to trying things that we would certainly consider to be abhorrent or at least illegal. Mm-hmm. According to international law.
Right, right. You also write that this book is about innovation, which seems a little more obvious here. What amazed me is just how creative some people got with their ideas. I mean, there's some amazing ideas here.
Well, you got to get creative. I mean, I think these are problems. And again, I mentioned that the intelligence and the military are about solving problems. And most of the problems, by the time they get to the CIA, or by the time they get to OSS, which is the precursor to CIA in World War II, they were not solved by a bunch of other people, right? They're hard enough that they got passed down to the intelligence agencies. If they were easy, they would have been solved by someone else, the State Department or diplomats or the military, the conventional military. That means these problems are incredibly difficult, and you've got to be creative. You've got to think way outside the box. Because innovation and creative thinking is the only way you can possibly solve some of these problems.
Hmm. You also write, to get the most out of this book, you should heed the advice of Master Yoda. You must unlearn what you have learned. And that means what?
Well, it means that if you tackle this book knowing what you know in 2019 and applying that to these stories, it won't be very informative. You'll just kind of laugh at them. I mean, they're still going to be funny. Mm-hmm. I didn't intend to write a comedic book, but these stories are funny just inherently. It's hard to make them not. But you won't learn anything. And I'm a historian. I take it seriously, even though these are funny stories. And if we apply our hindsight, the fact that we know we won World War II, the fact that we know the Cold War ended without firing a shot in anger between the United States and the Soviet Union, that kind of clouds our judgment of the people who are planning these operations or planning these technologies. It makes us go, geez, what were they thinking? Mm-hmm. And to me, that's unfair. And I want people to ask that same question, right? But I want them to ask it differently. I want people to go, what were they thinking? Kind of what fears, what desires, what's going through their minds? Because that's how we can learn from history, by putting ourselves in the shoes of those that are dealing with this on a day-to-day basis. You know, when we planned on Acoustic Kitty, we had no idea we were going to win the Cold War. When we were planning on potentially using biological weapons in World War II, this is the very beginning of our war. Right, we had just gotten beaten our pants off in North Africa by the Germans. Mm-hmm. We didn't know we were going to win. So we can use our hindsight and judge these people for the decisions that they made, but that's just not fair to them. And even more, it's not fair to us because we don't learn anything from it. And right. I'm an educator. I want people to learn from history.
You know, I can't help but wonder how tough these ideas were to research.
Some of them are easier than others. Some of them were incredibly difficult. And I think that what I ended up choosing – that. In the end, there are about 50 stories that I compiled before I kind of hunkered down and wrote this thing. And the decision that I made was that I would only include stories that people could go back behind me and research bits and pieces of it, if not the entire thing, on their own without going into an archive and spending weeks and weeks and weeks at the National Archives. Mm-hmm. Now, this doesn't mean I only pulled stuff from online. This doesn't mean that I only went to books that were already written. There are some wonderful people out there that have scanned hundreds of thousands of primary source secret, usually formerly secret documents online. And they're not easy to find, but I've tried to provide at the back of the book the reader with a way to go do more reading on all these stories. The key, of course, is figuring out what stories to have in the first place. Mm-hmm. And that's what took a ton of time. It took a lot of time for me to dig these up because in many cases, not in every case, they don't happen. But in many cases, people hadn't even heard of them.
Well, how about this story? Let's go to some specifics here again. You tell in this book, and one is attaching mini bombs, in a sense, to bats, of all things. What was the logic behind this idea? Because, again, on so many levels, it sort of makes sense when you first hear about it.
And this one might have worked. And actually, the guy who came up with this idea to his deathbed decades after World War II swore that it would end the war as easily as the atomic bombs did, with far less Japanese deaths. And the logic behind it was something we all kind of learned in third grade, is that bats during the day will do everything they possibly can to find a cool, dry, and dark place. Usually it's a cave, but sometimes it ends up being our living rooms or our attics or somewhere like that. Well, the concept behind that was, if we can drop bats over Japan with incendiary devices attached to them, so mini little bombs, they will fly into the attics and eaves and nooks and crannies of Japanese homes and buildings and structures to try to find that cool, dark, and dry place. Well, most of Japan at the time was built of wooden and even some cases paper buildings. So a bat plus a napalm incendiary device plus a paper and wooden building, you could burn Japan to the ground without developing nuclear weapons, without throwing tens of thousands of Marines, solar sailors, and airmen onto the beaches of Japan. You could win the war with very little loss of life.
So why didn't we try it?
Well, we tested it, and we tested it a lot.
We actually built a fake village in the California desert, right?
Yeah, where now Edwards Air Force Base is, out in the Mojave Desert. We built a fake Japanese village right near a working U.S. Army air base, and we tested it, and it worked perfectly. It actually burned the Japanese fake village to the ground. Now, unfortunately, also burned the U.S. Army air base to the ground, because it was very difficult to guide the bats directly with the way you wanted them to go. And that caused some problems, but really got to the point where it was ready for a full-scale workup. And they went to the U.S. Navy, and this was a Navy program at the time, and they asked the Navy for the millions of dollars it would take to fit tens of thousands of bats with incendiary devices. And of course, I haven't told you anything about timing in this case, and I don't in the chapter two on purpose, because when they finally put the request to Chief of Naval Operations Ernest King, it was the summer of 1945. And King was like, well, this sounds like it might work, but there's this project happening right now in New Mexico that I know is going to work. And we've already spent $2 billion on it in 1940s money. And so the request for the money to do the bat project was turned down because, of course, the atomic bomb was ready to be used against the Japanese.
Another issue here, bats are a little bit like cats. You can't train them either, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a real problem, is that you know, once you drop them over Japan, you don't care where they go. Mm-hmm. But it's very difficult in the Mojave Desert to dictate, go to the fake building versus go to the real U.S. Army airfield hangar or flight deck or guard tower or anything else. And they all burned down wonderfully. So proof of concept worked. It made a lot of angry Army soldiers because they no longer had an airfield they tried to use.
Vince Houghton is my guest. He's an historian and curator of the International Spy Museum in Washington. His new book, Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots, Left on the Drawing Board. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, I was agog at this idea. The Navy attempted to create an artificial tsunami to defeat Japan in World War II. How are they going to do that?
Well, this was more of a testing stage. They never quite got to the point where they thought they could pull it off. But the idea was, looking at underwater explosions, some personnel from multiple nations, actually the New Zealanders and the Americans and the British, noticed that it kind of caused waves. And the idea was, well, if small explosives cause small waves and bigger explosive cause bigger waves, they kind of extrapolated that if we use large enough explosives, we could create a very large wave. And knowing the power of tsunamis, and again, thinking about 2019 hindsight, look at the tsunami that hit South Asia
right.
a couple of years ago.
Right.
Talking about hundreds of thousands killed. And you know, that was an idea that made a lot of sense to them. So they did a lot of testing outside of New Zealand, where they geared up different levels of explosives to try to see if they could create an artificial tsunami that would be a way to end the war. And this was a program that never got a chance to fail because of the atomic bomb. And a lot of these programs, are ideas that never came to fruition because they were superseded by other events. This is not a book full of failed ideas. In fact, not a single program in this book actually got a chance to fail. And that's what's so interesting about it, the idea of creating a tsunami, which would have absolutely no distinction between civilian and military, like the atomic bomb, it would kill everything. And maybe, you know, again, looking at some of the ones in Indonesia and Japan, it would kill maybe a million people. This is an idea that we had that we thought would help to end the war. And the only reason it wasn't pursued all the way through, like full large-scale testing, was that the atomic bomb ended the war before they got a chance to do it.
I mean, was the thinking that this tsunami would wipe out the entire island? Because as awful as it is, an atomic weapon would be, you know, more limited in scope here.
Well, I think the idea was that if you could use a tsunami, let's start with, you know, Tinian Island, or let's start with Saipan, or let's start with Okinawa, then you could kind of gear it up and almost island hop your tsunamis all the way to mainland Japan. And if you could do it once, you could do it again and again, and you would never have to kind of launch troops or Marines or anybody else. You could just use nature to wipe. I mean, look, we end up using nature to beat the Japanese in the end anyway. This is just a different concept. Instead of using nuclear science, this case would be using kind of geology and oceanography to try to defeat the Japanese.
Yeah. How about the plan in the 1970s to actually dig a tunnel to the Soviet embassy so that the U.S. could listen into conversations? Why was that idea even considered?
Well, this is actually a pretty brilliant idea. I mean, the Soviets built what is now the Russian embassy in an area of Washington, D.C. called Mount Alto. It's up near the zoo. Gorgeous northwest D.C., but it was built up on a hill. And people were a little upset about that because it had a line of sight to a lot of important places in Washington, like the White House. And if you want to do signals intelligence collection, bringing in signals and stealing information, it's good to have a high level, you know, a high place where you can put antennas on your roof and kind of listen into conversations. So we kind of had to make lemonade out of lemons in this case. And the FBI and the NSA decided, all right, well, they want to build it up on a hill. Then we'll dig up under the hill and we'll tap into their communications from below. And so the FBI actually took a house nearby and a house across the street. They used a house across the street to surveil the actual embassy. And the house nearby, they basically took jackhammers to the living room and dug a tunnel down in through the living room of the house. And then over and under the Soviet embassy.
What happened then?
Well, the Soviets knew it was happening. That was the problem.
the whole time, turns out.
Yeah, this is an FBI operation. And unfortunately, at the time, the Soviets had an FBI, a high-level FBI agent on their payroll, a man named Robert Hansen, who we get in arguments all the time about who's the most damaging spy in U.S. history. Sometimes it's John Walker. Sometimes it's Alder Games. Bob Hansen is in that conversation every time. He blew so many operations for us in over decades that he spied, not just for the Soviets, but also for the Russians. So Hansen had told him it was happening. And so it never would have worked otherwise. But it was an interesting idea that was really, it's kind of one of these things where you're adaptive. You kind of find ways to, you have a problem, you need to figure out a way to solve it. And this is one really interesting decision that they made. It's still a bit of a tourist location. The idea is this house was there for decades after the fact, boarded up. And a lot of people are like, oh, is that the house? That was the Operation Monopoly Tunnel. Now it's just a flat, empty lot. So they finally tore down the house. But it's not hard to identify because this is an area where real estate is incredibly expensive. And so when you're driving along and you see a flat, empty lot, you know, ooh, there's a reason for that. And that was the original part of the tunnel.
Another one I really liked a lot, the aircraft carrier made of ice. Whose idea was that? And what are we talking about here?
Well, this is again, solving the problem of World War II aircraft carriers not being very powerful and not being very big. And if you wanted to land aircraft on them, the aircraft had to be light. They had to be lightly armed. They had to be lightly armored. And so they really couldn't do a whole lot. Aircraft carrier-based aircraft in World War II were not very good. And that's problematic if you're actually taking them head-to-head with land-based aircraft, which is exactly what was happening. The aircraft carriers were being used to support land operations. And so lightly armored, lightly armed aircraft were flying in and going up against ME-109s and the top German aircraft and getting their behinds kicked. So the idea was, what if we could build a very, very large aircraft carrier that could hold all sorts of aircraft and was unsinkable. Now, we'd love to have that today, but certainly, you know, even today we don't have the technology to do that, the unsinkable part. We can make much bigger aircraft carriers, but at the time they were limited. Certainly they're limited by how much steel they could use, because steel was needed for tanks and everything else. So a man named Jeffrey Pike, who was an inventor, he invented all sorts of things, walked into the British Admiralty and said, "Hey, look, I got an idea. Why don't we build an aircraft carrier out of an iceberg?" I mean, look, anyone who's had an ice cold drink on a hot summer day and has kind of taken the straw and bonked the ice cube and realized the ice cube pops right back up to the top of your drink understands the concept behind this. Icebergs aren't going to sink. So you could take your submarines and blast away at them with torpedoes all you want, and the iceberg aircraft carrier is going to stay afloat. And you don't need to use any steel because it's a big block of ice. You can use your steel for other things. Now, this was tested. They actually tested this significantly because an American group of scientists came up with a way to even reinforce the ice even more by creating, basically taking paper mache or newspaper and mixing in with the ice, creating a concept called pikecrete that was hard as steel in some cases.
That's amazing.
So up in Canada, they actually tested this stuff. They built a scale model of this. They realized how hard it would be to build a massive one. And so the program is canceled. But what's amazing about this is the scale model they built. They just abandoned it in a Canadian lake. It lasted for a year before it melted.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Vince Houghton has been my guest. His new book, Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. Vince, thanks for a good conversation. I sure appreciate it.
I appreciate you having me.
You bet. Tomorrow on the show, we'll hear from Johnson County librarians with summer reading recommendations for your kids. The new mayor, the next mayor-elect of Kansas City, Missouri, will also join us. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Emily Aiken. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.